teacher.
No.
Go back to work. This is totally ad lib. You've never heard this song. But her skills are because she spent a lot of time practicing. Still minor by a real musician's stance, which you'll now see how serious it is. It's a serious business. So here's the concert director at Carnegie Hall. We got there. Now watch this. 85-year-old conductor, Skitch Henderson. It's business. I mean, you can't work it out. Do it. That's Buggy Pizzarelli there. Bucky Pizzarelli. And I forget. Isn't it great? I love it. Hell with a lecture. Just watch this. Anyway, so all that's going on, and now let me tell you a little neuroscience behind it. So here's work done. Out here at in California, UCSF, an animal learns to discriminate a 2.5 hertz sound, and prior to the training, the representation for that sound is of this size in the auditory cortex. And after the training, the map spreads, it grows. There's some greater representation and commitment of the cortex to being able to discriminate that tone. And over here is a study of string players and the amount of cortex that's committed to the fingering in the left hand, and these are measures of the amount of number of neurons recruited, and this is the non-musically trained, this is the musically trained but kind of put it down, and these are active musicians. There is clearly tangible, physiological, measurable changes in brain function as the result of musical training. And the question is, coming back to this recurrent theme, are these going to just remain specific to the skill that's been practiced, or are they going to generalize through more cognitive activities? Here's some fMRI scans on people who are non-musicians listening to music versus musicians. Different part of their brain's involved if you're a musician. The activation you see there is in the left hemisphere of the musicians because they're dealing with it on a more symbolic level. That's G flat, D, E, B, you know. And the non-musicians are just saying, hey, it's a nice piece of music, you know. So that's me on the left. That's Skitch on the right. Okay. So I'm going to end up then with a startling example that comes from chess. And in doing that, I get to tell you 2 minutes about a mechanism in the brain that we all have that makes it so difficult for us to really understand why we think we're able to do something. Okay? And this comes out of work I started 40 years ago right down the street here at Caltech, probably the best scientific institution in the world, in my opinion. And it was on split-brain patients who were originally operated on here in Southern California. And these are patients who had the two hemispheres of the brain separated in an effort to control epilepsy. This structure, the corpus callosum, was cut. And the idea by cutting it was the left brain no longer could talk to the right and vice versa, if a seizure started, it would remain localized to one brain and there wouldn't be an overall loss of convulsion and loss of consciousness. So there's the medical aspect, which we're not going to talk about. What we're going to talk about is the neuropsychological consequences of that surgery, which is what I studied. And basically, it's simple. Just think of it this way. You got a left hemisphere, as you see there where I have the arrow, and that's your talking, speech, powerful hemisphere. That's the one that allows for symbolic thought and all the rest. And you have a right hemisphere that allows for perceptual grouping, maybe some kinds of emotional management, attentional management. It does other things. It doesn't do the heavy-duty thinking, okay? So what happens? Well, you split someone's brain and you show them a picture, as you see there. One side, you see a chicken claw, and that goes to the way you're built. Is that picture of the chicken claw goes to your left brain. It goes over here. And since that's your speech center, you would say, I saw a chicken claw. And then at the same time, we showed you a picture of a snow scene here. That goes to your right hemisphere. That's the way you're built. But now, because we've cut the connection between the two hemispheres, you can't talk about that. You say you didn't see anything. So that's the basic split brain effect. But what we showed was that while you may not be able to say anything, the hand that it gets its control from that right hemisphere can point to matching little objects. And in this particular case, we gave it the patient a simple little concept test. Here's a picture of a chicken claw, goes to the left hemisphere, let the right hand point to the most relevant object, which would be the chicken. Here's a picture of a snow scene, right hemisphere sees a snow scene, its left hand goes out and points to the shovel as the most relative object, related object. So the patient does that. It's sitting there and responding just like that, just like you see in the cartoon. And now we, it took us 25 years to think to ask this question, but, that's the way it goes. We finally got around to asking Paul, this is case PS, Paul, why are you pointing like that? Now we know why the right hand's pointing to the chicken claw. He knows, but he's talking out of his left now. You see, that's the side of his brain. He's talking to the world. But what does the left hemisphere think about the fact that his left hand is pointing to the shovel? What's up? What's going on here? So we say, Paul, why are you doing that? And Paul says, well, that's easy. He says, the chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed. So it's an interpretation of a behavior that's coming out of your body. And we've gone on over the last 30 years and shown how we spin stories about mood. We can manipulate your mood and then ask you why you feel, and you cook up some story as to why you feel a particular way when we actually goosed you to feel a particular way. Or we get you to do something. Here's another example of it from another case.
To the word. Again, Joe sees two words simultaneously. Bill goes to his non-speaking right brain. Music to his speaking left brain. When asked to point to a picture of what he saw, he chooses Bell. But when asked why...
Yeah, why'd you pick that one? Music.
Music.
And when asked to explain...
There was music and Bell. And it was a few minutes ago, the last time I heard any music was coming from the bells out here. Banging away.
So the bells outside here.
So, look good enough answer to me.
What's extraordinary is that Joe's speaking left brain concocts a plausible story of why he pointed to Bell, even when some of the other pictures more obviously represent music.
So, our left hemisphere's got something in it that tries to spin a story, tries to figure out why, how X relates to Y, tries to figure out the pattern of our own behavior, our own feeling, your behavior, your feeling. And our right hemisphere does something else. There's a simple task I could give you where I tell you to fixate a point and I tell you to predict where the light's going to come on above or below the point, right? Simple little task like that. And I rig it so that 80% of the time, in fact, it comes on above. And you go along, and what you try to do, instead of just always picking the top button, which would find you rewarded 80% of the time, you try to figure out the pattern because you're a smarty pants, like all of us. Now what happens is you only figure it out 68% of the time. And as a result, the rat, which doesn't have this system, figures to go hit the top button all the time and gets rewarded 80% of the time. So that's called maximizing. And the other one's called probability. So this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out the story. We're trying to figure out things that we actually don't know the answer to, and we come up with pretty fancy tales. And nowhere does this become more evident in the last example here. No more does this become more evident in the learning of chess. Chess is another mental skill. And it turns out the ability to apprehend patterns, perceptually group, so you can see there a cube, that's a right hemisphere function. We know that. Bunch of studies. And the question is it the case that what's happening in chess, grandmaster chess players, that they're learning the game by using, through thousands and thousands and thousands of trials, patterns to see on a chessboard? And it goes like this. There is a famous study done many years ago where they took grandmaster players and they would present to them on a card a chess game. And they'd show it to them for 5 seconds and then put the card down. Now, if I do that to you, you will get about 4 or 5 of the chess players on the right spot. These people were getting 26 out of 28. Okay, just like that. And here's one such guy. This is Patrick Wolfe, a grandmaster that lives in Cambridge. And this is the study of my colleague Chris Chabris at Harvard. So here he's seeing a chess scene that makes chess sense.
So these are very cleverly chosen, I think, because it's clear that this one is obviously much easier to construct.
Although, once again, I'm sure, I'm always not sure what to do with this guy, you know? I'm not sure whether it's here or here. I've forgotten a rook. I think it's here. Okay.
All right. Now, same guy, a few minutes later, is given another. He doesn't know that the card is, it doesn't make any chess sense, except his brain seems to know it. Because now, all of a sudden, he becomes immortal. And he can't get more than 4 or 5 positions right. And listen to him.
Why can't I remember it? I see it. And I try to cluster these things, and I can't friggin' remember it after the card goes away. There's like something here. There's like a cluster of pieces here, and there's a cluster of pieces here, but
So they then do studies, and they discovered that, in fact, even in chess players of normal ability, where they look at the by studying the visual fields, they can determine that, in fact, the right hemisphere apprehends the chess sense boards much more quickly than does the left. And so there really is a building case that what these people are learning is that the right hemisphere has learned thousands of patterns of chess through their many, many, many years of practice and hours of practice. And it's kind of like a compiled computer program. It's really efficient. It's over there. It's sort of automatic, and it's out of consciousness. It's just what you know how to do. And then you've got this poor little interpreter trying to make sense out of this. So here are a couple shots of poor Patrick trying to tell us about his experience and his great ability.
What I was trying to do was just sort of absorb the position and understand where everything was clustered and try to quickly understand what was going on, establish some logical connections between things, and occasionally, I've almost never done this sort of thing before, so I don't have a good sense of how much time different things are going to take me. But the important thing is to try to make everything make sense.
Yeah, that's right. And now here he is, trying to make sense.
And this sort of goes right away because the pawn structure is like this, and this is a little bit tricky actually because white is just going to win by playing bishop a7, and that sort of dominates everything. So, like, that's why I can't remember where this rook is very well, because the most important thing is this and this and this pawn structure and this is happening. And it's just sort of hard to sort of pay attention to the rest because, like, if black does this, you're just going to stop the pawn like that, and you can play this next move, or you might even just be able to do this, you know, because queens, and then you just take
it. I can't watch it anymore. So it's like trying to explain your golf game, right? It's trying to explain how you do that sonata. It's like trying to explain how you do the pirouette. I mean, it's just... it isn't going to happen. You're going to learn those skills through other avenues, and you actually get into this chess thing, and masters and grandmasters will tell you that when they do the speed chess, where they're going around playing 25 guys, they see their hand go out and make the move before they know what the heck they're doing, and the hand knows it's because it's all being done perceptually at this automatic level, and to with the new brain imaging techniques, we're going to find out. And there's already interesting data on this point that people, for example, who play instruments requiring bilateral coordination of the hands, so string instruments, piano, and so forth, have changes in the nature of their interhemispheric communications, and they're different than from people who don't play the piano. And the question is, did they change as a result of instruction, or were they there priorly? And those are some of the answers that will be forthcoming from the studies that of this Dana consortium. So, you know, we're looking at the question of early start: is there going to be an impact on the brain that is not only for the increasing the improvement of the specific skill in question, but whether it translates out to other cognitive functions, to other executive skills. And that is the point, and that is the notion that we're trying to clarify. And next year at this time, there should be some real ability to talk about what the findings are, because they're right now all in progress. So why don't I end there? I probably talked too long, but end it at that.
One of the things that you ought to know is that Professor Gazzaniga made his international reputation many years ago and started the field, really, of cognitive neuroscience based on the two different sides of the brain. That was his great insight, and he's been living off it ever since.
Not bad.
and Janet here did a piece... some publication about muscle memory from the point of view of the dancer who goes out and doesn't think about the movements, but it's as if the muscles have a memory rather than the brain. And that's one of the things we do at Dana, put together the artist and the scientists, and sometimes they even agree. Well, we're open for questions on any subject. And we have a question from the muscle memorandum.
Mike, I just wanted to ask you, my understanding that these six different groups have a different piece of the puzzle. Could you just describe a couple of the different studies?
Yes. There's a sort of a high-tech group that's involving Stanford and Berkeley, which are using new ways of using brain imaging data to detect what are going to be individual variations in performance. So take people who perform differently. Can you actually go in and see if there are neuronal circuits identifiable that are different in one case than from the person who's, say, the poorer performer? And then will those change through time and training? Those methodologies are being developed, and there's there's suggestions that those are going to be very fruitful. Other people are studying the impact of bilingual training that Bill mentioned at the beginning. A colleague at Dartmouth has made the discovery earlier in another context that people growing up who are truly bilingual actually have a cognitive advantage on learning in learning. And this they're Canadians, and of course that was a hot issue in Montreal. And it turns out that instead of learning two languages at once impairing your cognition, it actually has an enhancing value. And now it turns out that may transfer to the arts. And so they're studying the role of early dance in bilingual measures and other language measures. And then there's a group at Oregon who are really doing a fine job on. The one group is taking children in the perfect experiment. This is very hard to do. Taking children and randomly assigning them to get rid of this problem of correlation that the person who does well on the piano practices because they're doing well because, you know. And just taking children, randomly assigning them to the intervention group that are getting arts training versus a non-intervention group and looking at the effect on that, and that's one of the studies that looks extremely promising. So, but way too early to talk about in any serious sense yet.
Yes.
You talked
about what you're exploring with metaphor readiness? There's a whole field of research that says that the reason that what underlies creativity is transferring of a metaphor from one domain to another. And so there's this wonderful example of Gutenberg, who had figured out the stamp, you know, could make an S. He just couldn't figure out, you know, a whole paper, you know, sitting there printing these little things. And he was stumped, and he went out to take a weekend off to a country inn that had a wine press. And he saw, all of a sudden, he saw the whole plate go down. He went, bingo! I'm going to use that, and that's how he invented the printing press. And there's a book written, Myth of Creativity. And I'm blocking on the author's name, but where he goes through and shows a bunch of the famous quoted creative activities. He goes to shows that the antecedents where the person had borrowed a metaphor from one area and applied it to the new situation, and it opened up their thinking. And people kind of casually say this all the time. So one of the people in our group is going to actually try to examine that formally.
Excuse me, but what was going on in your brain when you blocked on that name?
It was an iceberg Greenberg kind of block.
This is a football analogy?
No, I it's Robert.
No, I'm not asking you to remember it. I'm saying what is the process by which the left side of your brain is telling the right side, forget that name?
Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice to know that? I can't answer you there.
Well, you see, we stumped them.
But with a grant?
Takes some research.
Yeah, we need some research.
Yeah, you have good.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, it's supposedly 10 in 100 rather than just 1 in 100.
Is that right?
I just said, because my daughter is Chinese.
Yeah.
And she was listening to Cantonese for the first 40 months of her life.
Yes. Yeah. That's fascinating. They know about this in phonetic exposure to Japanese, that there's a critical period where if you don't hear the R, you grow up and you can never get it right. Right? They can't hear it and they can't say it. And
is that your experience?
That is with my family.
Yeah.
They've been here for 50 years and they cannot say.
Still not going to say it.
So and don't really hear it. It's the L and the R.
Yeah, the L and the R.
Really translate. They can't sort of get it.
the Japanese brain imaging guys say blood flow. You know, 'cause they can't get blood flow.
Albert Fuller.
So there's, you know, so there's some fascinating work going on in this by a psychologist, Pat Cool, University of Washington, where she actually has a large project going in Japan, where the idea is to expose young Japanese children to this phoneme, so that when they learn the English later on, it'll be part of their repertoire, and they've already learned. It's interesting. The fascinating part of the study, I just saw this, that the exposure can't be just a tape, an audio tape. You have to have a mouth speaking with eyes looking, and that part of that whole complex is what gets embedded. So,
yes.
I was interested when you said that there's evidence that people that speak two languages, bilingualism, mm-hmm. you used a general term, that demonstrates additional cognitive
right.
power.
Yeah.
In learning more languages. That had always been the assumption
yeah.
that little kids can learn lots of different
things. Right.
But you seem to imply a transfer into sort of other areas.
Well,
and then you made the reference to potentially seeing bands and other symbolic forms
right.
as comparably intertwined. And so I was thinking of what you put in there.
Well, in the bilingualism, the current hypothesis is that what is being learned is you're gaining skills in being able to switch attention to your working memory. So you increase your actual working memory capacity. Someone is saying a word that you are translating into the other language, and you're holding that online as you make that translation. And so, therefore, you've learned how to switch and use your working memory to hold something in consciousness while you work on something else. That skill then becomes generalizable to all kinds of other skills that you can use in life and in cognitive acts. So that's that hypothesis. In the music and timing issue, there's all kinds of Elizabeth Spelke at Harvard is part of the group is looking at whether there's going to be specific gains in particular kinds of mathematical learning. Because of the sequencing that goes on in musical training. Are you learning to parse the world in a particular way that will enhance particular aspects of math? And she's not just saying what's 2 plus 2, but she has a whole set of tests that analyzes math much more fundamentally. So this is all, you know, hopefully next year, what one could go through instead of telling you more generally about the role of practice and so forth in developing expertise, specifically the phenomenon. And I'm being a little bit vague now because we're just not there yet. We don't want to talk about it before we know about it. Yeah.
What's the timeline for the research?
Well, it started a year ago, a little over a year ago, and the first grant is 3 years, but by a year from now, and there's already some results, but we're going to hear them next week. We're kind of out of order here a week. I'm sorry about that. Nothing to do about it. But by this time next year, there ought to really be see which of these experiments are going to pay off and have some utility to them.
We plunked down $2 million for the 3 years,
right.
And that's we feel is a very good investment.
Just curious, you mentioned music and dance. Are there other art forms that you're using in these studies?
Yeah, there's. There is theater, and in fact, there is there's a new study out, and the person behind it will actually be at our meeting next week, Glenn Schallenberg, and he has shown strong effects on children who learn to act during their childhood years. On follow-up social reasoning tests are way advanced over, say, musicians or artists or dancers. And the theory is that by acting, you're putting yourself in the position of the other person and trying to feel their emotion and have to act their emotion. And so when you grow up, you can do this more quickly. And so when you grow up and you do the social reasoning assessment, they apparently are off the charts at it. And that's as opposed to people spending just as much time learning the piano or what have you. So that's fascinating finding. Yes. No, it's interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting.
My son had seizures when he was younger. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of neuropsych testing. And now he's like a really good guitarist. And I'm wondering if there are any studies, epidemiological, that look at neuropsych tests and musical ability or any connection between.
Need not be a connection, of course, right? I mean, it could. He just was going to learn to play the guitar anyway, right? And not related to the... Does he read music or does he just play by ear?
Mostly by ear.
Yeah. Turns out in all these music studies in the brain that you read about in the paper, they're studying, for the most part, people who read music. Okay? So here's this whole highly symbolic, complex process... And I am shocked to learn how many of your actual professional musicians don't read music. They don't know how to read music. Paul McCartney doesn't read music. This guy, David Yazbek, doesn't read music. And then you start going, Bob Dylan can't read music in the pop culture. I can't imagine you can get away with that in classical music. But anyway, so it turns out the studies have not... dissected out great musicians who read music versus great musicians who don't read music and how their what the representation may be in their brain. I bet there are differences.
Is there a question from someone who has not yet asked a question?
Yeah. They are. I just didn't mention that. There's going to be one of the groups is looking at visual arts. I don't know where we are on that one. That's probably why I didn't say anything.
As a matter of fact, I'm speaking with Robert Menschel, the chairman of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, who has expressed an interest to extend this from dance and music and drama to the visual arts as well. So we're looking into that. Yep, back there.
Interesting. That's makes sense in some sense, doesn't it? So they're motivated students. They want to do something. They can. Yeah. I mean, when I don't know. Let me think about that. That's an interesting point.
I interviewed a great educator once and asked him what the greatest challenge to American education was. So was it ignorance or apathy? And he replied, "I don't know, and I don't care." Yes, ma'am.
There was a lot of interest several years ago about something called the Mozart effect.
Yes.
And can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, it had a great facilitatory effect on matters, but they couldn't prove it. They couldn't reproduce it, and it's because they were probably not measuring carefully enough the subcomponents. When you say there's an improvement in math, that doesn't mean anything. What component in math? And that's what Spelke's an expert at. Is you don't just give a general assessment test. It's the various components that go into a mathematical concept. You want to see if there's been enhancement there, or one of these more general cognitive things like attention switching and the rest. Yeah, I'm just waiting to see. I mean, I look at my children, which I had some genetic input to, and they have two or three of them are really artistic. I mean, from writing to acting to dance to music. It didn't come from me. It's a total mystery. Well, not a total mystery, because my wife contributed. But she can be a total mystery sometimes.
Any other questions? Well, I think, Professor Gazzaniga, that wraps it up. Thanks very much.